author Melina Watts about her book called Tree.
He was the king of trees, keeper of the leaves, the deep green god of a young love-stained memory. We used to meet by him, far from the hustling town. I loved you, now I've come to cut you down. Burn the leaves. Don't burn the leaves. And if my mind breaks up in all so many ways, I know the meaning of the words I love you. And if my body falls inside an early grave, evergreens are coming to take me back so slowly as I roll down the track. The forest and the evergreens are coming to take me back. The forest and the evergreens are coming to take me back. Lay the road.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. I'm Stephen Schutte. Our guest today is Melina Watts. She's written a fascinating novel called Tree. It's a piece of magical fiction written from the perspective of a live oak. Melina was previously on this program a few weeks ago with Alan Hartorn discussing the Wild and Scenic Film Festival. She worked on that as an organizer.
I'm Susan Schutte. Melina was born in Southern California and is now living in Chico. After beginning her career in Hollywood, working for Peter Horton, Frank Marshall, and Kathleen Kennedy and DreamWorks, Melina shifted her focus to resource conservation. Welcome, Melina. It's nice to have you here.
Thank you. I just love that you two have created this show and provided so much joy and information to everyone in Northern California over so many years.
Thank you. And it's not always joyful, but this will be a very joyful interview.
Right.
We describe ours sometimes as the doom and gloom show as we talk about.
Well, that's just telling the truth, right? And we got to tell it if it's ugly sometimes.
Right. Yep. So, Tree is a magical book of magical realism. It's been well reviewed all over the country. We read the book. We loved it. We found it engaging both spiritually and ecologically. A lot of ecological information in there, but it's also a spiritually uplifting book. How did you come to write a book from the point of view of a tree?
Well, I used to have trouble telling the story, but I finally decided you just have to embody your lived truth, right? Which is that when I was a young woman, I had a series of mystical experiences with plants. The most vital of which was I was down at UC San Diego my freshman year. It's true, I ended up going to UCLA and graduating from UCLA, but my freshman year I was down there. And I really had gone from this incredibly emotionally complex, wonderful all-girl high school to feeling totally alone and isolated in college. Like I had no one to be with. No one cared where I was. It was Friday night. Everyone else was at a party today. And there I was just feeling so lonesome and depressed, almost suicidal, right? So I couldn't face going inside. And as the sun set and the stars started coming out, I walked to the grassy quad in front of my dorm room and I just lay down. And I had this feeling that a piece of grass in front of me felt my anguish and projected some kind of positive energy at me. I call it light, for lack of a better word. It wasn't physical light, but it was this emotion of it radiating positivity and affection at me. And it was talking to me, right? So I was like completely blown away and they said, no, thank you. And the plant seemed to talk to the pieces of grass next to it and say something like, this young woman is in deep trouble. And they emoted at me. And then the grass is next to them and the grass is next to them until suddenly it was this experience of the entire field of grass was interconnecting and emoting at me. And I felt totally buoyed up and loved. And it was this absolute sense that the grass was alive and a part of me and I was a part of it. And so I really wrote this book for that field of grass and for all the plants that have given me, you know, love and care over the years. And I had this experience when I was at a really dreadful job from my perspective, where I had to go, you know, up to the seventh floor of a fancy building and be in a cubicle all day long with somebody who yelled at me a lot. And he had gone to a luncheon at Spago's in Beverly Hills, where there's going to be a lot of wine involved in a Friday afternoon. And I knew I had the afternoon kind of just locked to my desk doing nothing. And while I was sitting there with all this, my work was done, my time was done, I had this epiphany that I wanted to tell the story of a tree from the tree's point of view. And so the experience of trying to imagine life from a plant's perspective, where you never leave the same spot, where, you know, your roots interconnect and stay where they're put, where you have this very, these other plants that are interconnected with you and animals and your whole world is a place where you grow. So wanting to tell that story was the genesis of Tree.
We want to ask you to read a little bit for us. We might point out beforehand, this may come up or not. You use an alternative pronoun for the tree and for the grass, which figures prominently in the book. Maybe you could give us a clue as what that pronoun is and why you chose to use it. And then we'll ask you to read to us.
Sure. You know, when I was researching, there are certainly plants where you have a male tree and a female tree and they have to pollinate each other for things to work. But the majority of trees, including oaks, have sort of male and female structures. And then the wind or the insects pollinate it, right? Or they can even kind of pollinate themselves sometimes. And I felt that to call a plant it was very eviscerating of its life force. Because an it is an inanimate object, right? And trees are the opposite of inanimate. They're full of vibrancy and life. And I felt that their romantic life is totally different than what we have, but it's real for them. It's kind of more polyamorous, if you will, right? So I wanted to create a gender that could be male and female simultaneously. So I invented this word e. And what's really interesting about that is when I started writing the book, you know, the people who are not close friends of mine who read it were like, you're crazy. No one's going to want to read this. And then partway through the experience of writing it, it turned out in India, people who are transgender wanted to have a different gender to identify themselves with legally as they voted. And they started using the word E. They'd never met me. I'd never met them, but we were on the same page. And so what's super interesting is I wrote this book about plants and I have people who are gay, lesbian, and transgender going, oh my gosh, this is us. And I'm like, oh, okay. Like I'll take it. I hadn't thought of it that way, but I think it's interesting, right? Yeah. So my children, interestingly enough, will use the word E completely organically to mean something that's alive that isn't male or female, and they don't understand what other people don't understand, right?
Yeah.
Interesting.
So I found myself, as I was reading, just slipping into the E pronoun very comfortably, so it becomes automatic after a page or two. Okay, you're going to read to us.
Thank you. Okay, so at this point... The tree has just sprouted and has just had a day of sunlight. And after, and because of the way tree sprouted, it was kind of sunlight starved. That first day of sunlight was like so empowering. And so this is what happens next.
Okay, hold on. Let me find the right spot. This always happens to me. Okay. And in the midday sun, the tree, for that it was what it was becoming with each passing moment, quivered in the first burst of light it had ever seen, felt, smelt, known. Like all trees and fully sentient plants, tree experienced all the sensations that animals know in a simultaneous burst coming in at tree's core from every exposed cell and tree's outside. Top, bottom, sides, roots, tree experienced the full extent of being alive in one brilliant moment and then shrank for an instant. It was nearly too much. But tree found inside a hunger for this hot light, for this dusty air, for the sky that drove tree to reach up and up. Tree's tiny taproot dove down, open in every cell to bringing in the water from the bloody ground that would grow it up. Meanwhile, the beginning of tree's trunk strove and unfurled, snapped up teeny and tall, moving up through the crack. At the end of the day, the proto trunk was still technically just subterranean, but tree's interior core was skybound. As the sun moved away and tree felt, saw the colors of sundown for the first time, tree felt an aching joy, sadness, that felt like love, and then a sharp horror when the sun altogether disappeared. How could tree survive without the hot light? Where was the love? Night grew cold quickly, and the sky went from purpley blue to navy to black, shiny, smooth, and immaculate. Tree felt loneliness and fear, and inside tree's core, tree knew the hot light had abandoned tree forever. The pre-trunk curled down, looking for the comfort of the earth in the absence of sun. But then little blinky lights popped up in the sky like surprise visitors, and tree could see, feel that the sky was populated with friendly entities. Not one of them made tree feel fed, loved at core, but tree could feel distant affection, and that was surely better than the starving grief of sunset. A big yellowy-white globe came out to the sky, and tree felt, looked up, shivering in the night at a kind of pure beauty that had nothing to do with tree's core growth and everything to do with whatever it was that this living thing was about. Tree felt a distant, amused warmth and slender affection and asked this large entity for protection and very quietly asked it to bring back the hot light. Tree asked the night globe for the hot light in the next instant because it felt better to have help in such a big world than to be in it all alone. And because it made Tree feel more hopeful and because Tree believed that this was all an efficacious act, Tree asked again in the next instant and the next. And the next, and the next. A minute passed, 10 minutes, a slow half hour. Finally, an hour. Hot light, please. Oh, hot light, please. Oh, please. Oh, please. Oh, hot light, hot light, hot light. Oh, please. Oh, night globe. Oh, beautiful, kind. Oh, night globe. Oh, my lonely friend. Oh, my lonely me. Oh, please. Oh, please. Please. And such for an hour and another hour and on until night began to wane. The night globe disappeared over the west. Till and tree felt a stab of grief that fully rivaled tree's first pain not so long ago. But the color of the sky was changing in the east to dark blue, then to light blue, and finally a shiver of deep pink came up along the horizon and a smudge of red, and then the hot light came up, first just an upside down smile of lights, and then more until a segment of lychee sat along the east hill, and then it turned into a whole sun. And tree knew pure, radiant joy and sent out every speck of love in its tiny core to sun. And sun knew.
Right. I really love that. And I really like where it is a combination of the spiritual and the natural, the ecological. And so specific with such great details. Could you talk a little bit how you've learned about the sprouting of acorns, and have you grown acorns into trees?
Well, I want to go back to what you said about liking the science and the spiritual thing.
Yeah.
I think as two people who run a show called Ecotopia, you'll understand what I mean. I think this whole division between science and spirituality is completely artificial. Yeah. And most of the scientists I know are driven by a passionate love of nature in a kind of emotional spiritual connection to it that they may or may not articulate, right? Mm-hmm. So at first I thought, you know, all my science friends are going to have my head on a platter when this book comes out. And it was the other way around, where they're like, oh, you're telling my secrets finally, right?
Nice.
In terms of learning about acorns, the first thing I did, I rapidly realized after I had my epiphany and I kind of wrote like crazy for 3 days, it was totally joyful, exuberant, over the top experience. Good Lord, I need to learn a lot more about all of this to do this right, you know? So I went to this 1 day class at UCLA that was a life history of oaks, and it was a bunch of different scientists in a row. And one of them told me, oh, you should go up to the Resource Conservation District of the Santa Monica Mountains. You can use our library. And I was like, oh, goody. So I went up there, and it was this beat up trailer, and it, you know, 50 years old, falling to pieces, but it had a stunning library of all this kind of stuff I needed. And it had a job offer that ended up becoming the basis of my other career in resource conservation, right? But I started reading books about oaks and the life history of oaks, that I actually felt like I probably should have published this book with a huge bibliography, because I did so much research, mm-hmm. right? And then I went to people who like Matilaha Nursery in Southern California, run by Matilaha Bob, and I interviewed him, and I asked about, you know, the life cycle of oaks, because he grows them. And it was very important to me to know how much it grew each year, so that I could accurately have it fit the storyline, fit the timeline. And the timeline is actually very important to this novel. So I did stuff like look up, what are the drought years of the last couple hundred years? What were the big fires? When were the earthquakes? You know, it wasn't just, when did the Spanish come? When did the rancheros come? When did the cowboys come? It was actually figuring out, oh my God, this was a terrible year for rain, and that we lost half the ecosystem or whatever, right? So,
wow.
Could you talk a little bit about, well, we both have questions. I wanted to ask about managing the point of view, because the Native Americans, the Mexicans, the cowboys come on the scene. They are not always within trees' range of vision. And I didn't realize that at first. I was reading along, and suddenly we're off the scene elsewhere. So how did you work that back and forth so you could tell the stories of these various families across many decades, 200 years, while still keeping it focused on the point of view of tree?
Well, my main conceit in the story, in terms of the tree's experience, is much like a human baby, where, you know, you see your parents, you're happy, but you can't say, like, you know, let's go to the park today, because you're a baby, right? So it takes a while to grow up and into our ability to be articulate. So I envisioned that that was the same for the tree. And in particular, I envisioned that trees' ability to interconnect first with some grass and then with some other trees was a more reasonable, you know, plant-to-plant communication. And that tree was really morbidly fascinated by animals, because they were moving, which creeped it out, right? Like the ants walking by is like, oh my goodness, they're moving, you know? And with the Chumash have a very, you know, almost all the Native American communities in California used acorn as sort of the basis of their economy. It was a really important plant. And if you look at acorns as compared to like rice or wheat or even corn, it has a higher fat content and higher protein content. So you're less likely to starve to death if that's your main food source, right? So in the Chumash tradition, an extended family would own a grove of trees. And then within the tribe, somebody else would own other trees. And it wasn't like owning, but it was like, these are the ones we're allowed to harvest. And you would only harvest, say, half of the acorns, because you're supposed to leave it for the other species. Otherwise, you're a jerk, because there was a concept of like, we all are part of this living biodiverse thing, and we can't eat all the acorns, right? So tree becomes aware that the Chumash are eating its acorns, and that this one young woman has a special feeling about tree, but tree has not figured out how to connect with the Chumash. So then when we move into the Ranchero era, I really wanted to dig into this one Ranchero family and their experience of living in the valley that tree lives in. So you really feel like they're your people as a person, right? So when this girl, this young woman experiences, you know, catastrophic death repetitively, and she's just like maxed out, and she escapes kind of the family funeral event, the second one, to go be by herself because she can't be around other people. Her grief is so powerful that the tree feels it. And then she is able to feel the tree trying to care for her. And that becomes the first human tree connection. And to me, that's the soul of the book, is that experience of like, we are not separate and other, we are together. And some of us have these experiences with trees. And what I'll share with you is every single book event I go to, somebody goes, that's my story. And I think I thought when I was writing it that I was like a freak. I was the only person who knew this, and no one was going to, people were going to think I was crazy. And it turns out, you know, like the woman who was a Chumash scholar who reviewed the Chumash section to make sure that, you know, I had gotten it right. And I'll tell you, the first draft came back with a lot of red ink. It was super humbling. But she said, you got to get over yourself. We all talk to trees, right? And they talk to us, right? So it's been delightful to hear this. And I hear this from different countries now with other readers in other countries that they're saying, oh my God, this is my story, right? You know, I don't know if that answers your question, but I wanted to do a shift where you went to the people stories and then back to the plant stories, so that when they intermarry, you're committed to the people as much as you're already committed to this plant community.
Right. And also the people are just attracted. They come back and lie down under tree at various points in their lives. They always find solace and support. So that's the way also we get back from their independent lives to their interconnection with tree.
Right.
Susan, I think you had a... Listeners, we're recording this from separate rooms rather than in the studio. So in the studio, I get to wave at Susan. We nudge each other. Susan, you have something to...
it's gone past now, but I want to talk a little bit more about all of the relationships that tree has, and particularly with other living things, but particularly tree's relationship with grass.
Yeah, that was the most emotionally intimate writing I've ever done in my life, is writing about Una Verbia, which is the grass, and tree. And, you know, what was super interesting about that experience for me is I found out there's some kinds of grass that they'll have an individual blade of grass, and then they'll basically make clones of themselves coming off their roots and then create more of themselves that are genetically identical. And this repeats and repeats and repeats. So there's places in Southern California where they think that a field of grass, a section of it, can be 10,000 years old. And all kind of like, and are they individuals? Are they the same plant? Are they brothers and sisters? It's very ambiguous. But then you have plants where it has a lifetime of 1 year and that's it, and it's dead. And then it has, you know, new baby plants, right? And so for tree, as an infant tree, if you will, as a sprout, it naturally connects to one of the plants right next to it. And its first conversation is with a grass. And so in effect, they're cross species best friends. And, you know, probably the toughest experience for young tree is the fact that that grass is an annual, and tree has a life expectation of 500, oak tree has a life expectation of 500 to 600 years. And so, you know, all that we're discovering, not we, but scientists who are working on this, about plant-plant communication is that they're using a fungal underground network to communicate. And it is, in fact, cross-species sometimes, number one. Number two, there's some kind of electrical communication that happens back and forth with plants that we're just beginning to feel out. And what I love about that, by the way, is the first scientist who did that was from India. And he was sort of a brilliant polymath that everybody loved in India. Sir Jagdish Bose was his last name. And if you have Bose Electronics, it's named after that. So he was a genius in physics, a genius in botany, and he wrote like early science fiction, right? So he did research that showed that plants are communicating electrically, and diverse, and shared this research in Europe in the late 19th century, early 20th century, and was soundly mocked. And now we're finding 100 years later, he was spot on, right? So I know that there's stuff going on. So I feel like there's credibility to it, but I wanted it to be an emotional story of interconnection so that we were with them experiencing their intimacy and also the chaos of root-root connection and how difficult that is.
Do a little announcement. You're listening to Ecotopia on KZFR. Our guest is Melina Watts. She's the author of a book called Tree, about a live oak told from the point of view of that tree. And I just wanted to kick in, you know, tough guys don't cry all that often, but I shed tears over the relationship of tree to Una Verbia.
So, can she read that? Susan, can you read that?
There's all sorts of parts of interview. What part did you want me to read?
Well,
you know what I like especially is the part where the deer comes by.
Okay.
Do you remember that part? Okay. I'll read that. And I'll share with you, since we're already saying that Univervia is an annual plant, so you can guess that Univervia dies. When my sister read her copy of it, she was texting me saying, in all caps, how could you do this to me? Yes. So it's
heartbreaker.
But I guess, you know, I feel like one side effect of this book is I'm having people tell me that this book has helped them process grief of people they loved that have passed. Yeah. I don't know. So let me see if I can find where I put the part where I want to read it. Okay. I think it's page 43 if you have your book, but I'll look for it. Bear with me. Nope, that's wrong. Okay, now we're going to go with 32, 33. Sorry. Okay, here we go. While the grass had known the prickly unease of deer herds before, their hooves severed the top portions of grass off and crushed young and old plants, causing the need to grow back over a week's time. And they ate the tops of plants, and sometimes they uprooted grass, and that was just that. They were blandly violent, oblivious to that which they caused. A velvety brown mouth came near the patch of grass, which included Dant, Vicium, and Univervia. A big bite took out Dant and Dant's pack of friends, severing them off at an inch above the roots. There was a universal shriek as the creature began grinding them down into food and the silence of a noble death thereafter. Dant, suffering a mortal wound, clung to the earth by E's roots, shivering at the disappearance of 90% of E's stems and blades. Univervia spoke softly. Dant, you are still alive. Don't fall asleep. Don't give up. Grow. Grow. You can heal and thrive. Shocked to the core by kindness from Univervia after having put you under a grass fatwa, Dant cried. Univervia continued, grow. Grow. And Dant clung to the command and put out a wish to form cells along the severed edge, oozing precious wetness into the air. Dant began to reconstruct. And in that moment, the deer's mouth came back in and neatly chomped out half of Univervia. Tree was electrified. It felt like his own core had been cleaved. To Tree's surprise, he could still feel the blade of Univervia that was on the deer's tongue. And the feelings that came at Tree were fast, intense, and surprising. The whole blade lay languid, surrendering as the tongue mashed the strands of grass up to the roof of the doe's mouth. Then the deer twisted the grass sideways and ground teeth into the grass. As the grass was destroyed, each cell popped and gave shots of grass life force into the hungry deer and little pops of ecstatic release. The whole thing happened as swiftly as a string of firecrackers going off into light and smoke, leaving behind a dull residue that gave no sense of the evanescent beauty that had been enchanting the air only moments before. Tree felt this chunk of Univervia embrace willful dissolution. And then suddenly, all these little pieces that had been integrated into Univervia were separated into something like Ananda, the joy which powers the universe. And then the grass was deer. Tree looked at the deer with newfound respect. On a fundamental level, the animal was grass. The deer itself was plant. Boggled by the insight, Tree could only be still and erect and watch the marauding deer move on. The cry of the half of Univervia, which remained, tore into Tree like watching a lover plunge off a cliff. Tree gasped out as a last-ditch effort, Univervia! And Univervia grasped at the contact. Am I alive? The shortened grass shrieked. Relieved to have made contact, to have heard a voice, Tree spoke with the majesty of a grown tree, completely silencing the entire bustling herd of grass. You are still here, and you will grow.
It's amazing how, you know, I feel like I'm looking through a microscope, how much detail there is and how closely I'm in touch with it. It's so cool.
Thank you.
You know, as a writer, I had this experience that I was seeing the world very intensely and probably not like other people as a child. And I wanted to create a book that would let people be experience it with me, like what it's like. Yeah. I think it's kind of fun, right?
Yeah. It's kind of pretty cool.
I wanted to note, too, that tree suffers damage at various points during the book, loses limbs in windstorms. And so tree, too, learns from Univervia's experience about restoration. It's a very different kind. The limbs come back, the sprouts come back.
Yeah.
But clearly tree has learned a lot from the Univervia experience.
Yes, and you know, there's a couple fires in the course of the book, because this book takes place in Topanga Canyon, which, you know, while we were having the Paradise campfire up here, back where I'm from, they were having the Woolsey fire. And, you know, historically, oak trees have kind of endured and survived fires, but for many reasons, the fires are hotter now than they used to be, so they're not doing as well. They're not bouncing back as fast. But I definitely wanted to have readers experience the fire from the oak's point of view of extremely painful, but possible to get through. And there were so many details I learned about that were so important to me to integrate into the story. Like, for example, oak trees during a fire shed every acorn on them, like on the spot, because their instinct, I don't know if that's the right word for a plant, but I'm going to call it instinct. Their instinct is, if I'm going to die, I'm going to make every baby I possibly can. Bam, you know, it's sort of touching.
Yeah.
And also tree is a very good scientist. Tree keeps learning, has experiences like the sunrise and the sunset early in the book. Doesn't know what those are, but by the time there's a third sunrise, tree has figured this out and knows it's a cycle, not just a one-time event. And likewise, tree comes to know when the fires are coming, senses, oh, there's a fire off in the distance. We better get ready for this one.
So yeah.
The second and third fires that come through, tree has made scientific observations and figured out what's going to happen next.
Yes.
I wonder if you could talk about some of the other critters that appear in tree's area. There's the turtle, skink, the mountain lion comes through multiple times. We've heard about the deer, and eventually horses come to Topanga Valley. Could you tell us a little bit about those and how tree relates to those critters?
Well, I wanted to definitely give a sense of the incredible array of species that coexist in this valley that I have some acquaintance with. And as I mentioned, I have this sense of tree as only understanding little bits in the beginning and gradually knowing more and more. So early on, when tree is still, I think, like 8 or 10 inches tall, the creek overtops its bounds and floods the valley, and you don't know if it's going to survive the flood, right? And a southern steelhead trout like bashes into it on its way swimming by. So that's like these kind of minor contexts, and then it expands into larger contexts. So initially, tree's first exposure to horses is the first time the Chumash are exposed to horses. And that's when you have the Spanish exploring before they actually decide to, you know, set up, in effect, plantation type of situations, right? And nobody's ever seen these before. So the tree refers to the horses as long-necked deer, right? Mm. Trying to understand them. And, you know, horses and all the domestic animals that the Spanish brought had this side effect of bringing with them hay and weeds and other Mediterranean plants that completely changed the ecosystem, like, incredibly fast. Scholars are saying that, there's a bunch of scientists who've taken adobe bricks from the earliest missions and homes, right, and picked them apart and looked at the pollen and the seeds, and they're saying the grass content was already almost entirely Mediterranean. That's how fast it was, right? So then later on, there is a horse that's kept in a pasture that trees area is sort of enclosed as a pasture at one point. And it's not well cared for. It's sort of slowly starving to death. And it's lonely. Horses are herd animals. And I actually think, you know, maybe we should have a law that you should only be allowed to have two or more horses, because having one horse at a time is tragic for the horse, because they want buddies. That's what their instinct is. So the horse kind of feels tree and hangs out near tree for company. But of course, the horse's hooves are damaging the tree's roots the whole time. So it's like this, the good news is you have a friend, the bad news is it's just very damaging to you, you know? So all these, lots of different animals in the story for that reason, to try and show how they all coexist.
You're listening to Ecotopia on KZFR. Our guest is Melina Watts, author of a book called Tree. Could we maybe fast forward a little bit closer to our own time? At some point in the not too distant past, people show up with surveyor's tools, plastic ribbon. They start laying out squares in Topanga Valley. If you could talk about that and maybe read a little bit about what started to happen in the valley at that point.
Sure. You know, in my 20s was sort of the 80s, and there was a lot of like McMansions happening, right? And so seeing how that impacted the ecosystem was very fresh. I remember coming home from college one day, and outside my home, the view was these mountains that had always had like natural, you know, ecosystems. And I got home at like 2 a.m. because of the train I'd taken or whatever. And I woke up and the entire hillside had been like, basically it wasn't trees. It was more like chaparral, but it had been clear cut for houses that were being stalled. And I remember how that felt. So I wanted to write about how that feels from the point of view of a tree. So let me see what page I'm on. I think I have it written down here. Bear with me, please. Yep. Okay. All right. Well, I thought I had it right there. Yes. Okay, here we go. This, you know, you always think you have your stuff ready for reading, and then you get anxious and you can't find it. So I appreciate your kindness while I figure out where I am. Okay. Change is the title of this chapter. It wasn't long after the men with machines came. Tree was utterly horrified to watch the road being put in. Trees and bushes and grass cleared, the surface scraped and mashed in hot, sticky asphalt, laid down. In a panic, Tree woke up Rock. "What is this? What is this?" Tree asked. Rock, laconic, said, "Man, volcano." But there was more, for soon the creek itself had cement laid down from one side to another in a seasonably accessible road/bridge in what the men called an Arizona crossing. Except the man from Arizona, he called it a Texas crossing. After a few days, the cement dried and they brought in equipment. First, 12 trees were chopped down. Tree had seen trees die before of old age, of insects, fungi, and even fire. But never had he seen this method that made his bark feel like he wanted to peel off his trunk. The first tree to go had been a young willow. In the way of the cement makers and the cement creek crossing, E's shriek of death had been instantaneous and had wounded Tree so severely and the other trees that they all shrieked simultaneously in response. This woke Rock. Rock felt E's best friend's pain and did what any rock should do for another. E wrapped E's own core around Tree's core and pulled E underground into a world of slow-growing crystals and dripping water that E had seen 1,000,000,000 years ago. Tree went into the darkness and then began to see as a rock sees, without perception of dark or light. Underground, each rock glowed to all the others, sending out a slow signal of being. As the stalactites slowly let water peel away morsels of itself, the stone relinquished the tiny fragments within winter water to the waiting stalagmite below, who took them on as wanted children, the one growing from releasing, the other from accepting. Tree found the process infinitely entertaining. Rock found the process infinitely entertaining, and his tree's core slowed down to understand this hidden world. For a time, he did too. The rock memories padded Tree from experiencing the rest of the day, but Rock could only sustain the visit for so long. And finally, he had to release Tree back into the world of growing things. The whimpering meadow stood before the hardening concrete, wondering what was next, and the men jumped on motorcycles and cars and raced up the road to who knows what for comforts no plant could ever fathom. There was one stump that was a foot wide and another stump that was 15 inches wide where the pair of California live oaks had once been saplings together, big and bigger. Dawn came after a lonesome night, and Tree found himself dreading the day for the first time in his life. Bulldozers arrived, and the men shouted and jeered, and as the men pushed aside every living thing on the meadow, putting it in a hump of dirt over the space where one of the yellow-scented strings had been, the bulldozers
retreated to cheers. A job done. Tree stood shaken. This wasn't grazing, when roots could sprout back or digested seeds could be shot out to grow more pre-fertilized grass. This wasn't a fire that laid down a rich layer of ash and encouraged hidden seeds to appear. This was something new. All the grass and chaparral had been uprooted and buried. Snakes had been cut in half and crushed by the bulldozers. The older bunnies had fled for the remaining chaparral, while the younger ones, too little to flee, had been crushed. Enormous familial cities of insects, gone. The wind whipped across the bare dirt and dust rose up to clog tree stomachs and choke man and beast alike. But the next day, the men were prepared with damp bandanas across their mouths, and down came a truck carrying what looked like a giant rolling pin, hard and metal and spiky. They attached it to the enormous machine, which powered it with a great man at the wheel. The purpose of this vehicle was to lay down the equivalent of a concrete foundation, something worth building a house on for all time. As the rolling pin was lowered, the men shouted. They had noticed rock, and rock was not crushed. They stopped with the rolling pin and got a winch and a crane to come over from a field out of visual range, and Tree guessed that other precious valleys were being destroyed on this bleak day. And the winch was attached to rock, and the crane, without leaving the far side of the creek, hoisted rock up and over and dumped it into a truck, which drove away. By the time Tree and Rock figured out what was being done, each was too far from the other to hear a goodbye. Then the vehicle pushing the rolling pin, itself taller than a man, came across the creek, and the driver lowered the pin, not only low enough to touch the ground, but enough to drive the ground 12 inches lower than it had been before. All the airspace between the dust and dirt, all the hidden places for insects to crawl and room to burrow was pushed out. The man pulled another lever, and the rolling pin drove even deeper, and the ground gave out first a sigh and then a squeaky noise like a mouse with the tail being stepped on. Concentrating, he began to follow the markings on the ground to create the foundations for the house. As he moved forward, the rolling pin came over the first tip of Tree's roots, flattening them like roadkill. Tree, of course, was still very much alive, and the pain caused him to give a great bellow that echoed across the whole of the valley and poured over the rim of the mountains. Trees who had never known Tree in 100, 200 years cringed in response. The compactor moved slowly forward, and Tree tried not to inflict his agony about the entire universe, but it was impossible not to yell. When the compactor had made a straight line, starting about 50 yards from the creek and heading back about 100 yards, he turned a right angle and headed straight towards Tree. Now the pain was escalated by pure terror. Was the machine going to knock Tree down or crush his roots up to the trunk? Tree yelled so loudly that the oldest tree in the forest, 2.5 miles away, as the red-tailed hawk flies, heard this moment of grief and terror and sent forth a love prayer, quiet as a flick of air. It reached Tree like a mother's embrace, and he clung to it as the compactor came closer and closer and then stopped a big 3 yards away, making another right turn and heading back to the creek. The half a day this took was the longest day Tree could imagine existing in the universe, for underneath every portion of the smooth, flattened dirt, now hard as concrete, lay miles of interlaced roots, both trees and those of other trees, and the long grass roots of purple needlegrass, dead now. More dead than he ever imagined, for nothing else would be able to eat them up and incorporate them into some new life. The other 3/4 of Tree's roots were shriveling and wriggling on the ground in terror. The driver lifted the metallic rolling pin, locked up and turned around and headed up the hill. His colleagues congratulated him on the project, swift and clean. Not a one of them had heard the shrieking, though one had a dog that was cowering under his master's old red Chevy, whimpering and moaning.
Wow.
Powerful.
Painful.
Piece.
Really painful.
We're not going to give away the end of Tree. The life expectancy of this live oak, as you said, is 500 to 600 years. It's about 250 years as of that moment when the spiky rolling pin comes through. And this also brings it right home to Chico. And Susan is a member of a group called Smart Growth Advocates. And maybe we could talk a little bit about really your environmental activism, what you see going on in Chico with suburban sprawl, urban sprawl, and what your thoughts are on where we are going as a community at this point.
As someone who's lived here for 2 years, I don't have an educated understanding of the extent of potential suburban sprawl that you're discussing. And, you know, I understand it's super serious. But I will say that my work has been on conservation, restoration, sustainable agriculture, creek restoration,
And so a lot of times that means working collaboratively with cities, agency, and landowners to try to fix what's broken. And so, you know, when people put in native plants and restore native hydrology, there's this remarkable opportunity to turn the boat around on terrible things that have happened in our ecosystems. I know that Friends of Butte Creek is working to put water back in stream to increase the amount of habitat, not only for salmonid populations, but all the adjacent riparian habitat and all the other species that coexist off a stream. If you fix the stream, many times you're fixing, you know, the ecosystem. One of the things I think we can do in Chico is think about climate action activities that we can do with urban planning to make things better. As an example, I would like to see more, it's a beautifully bike-friendly city compared to many cities, but that doesn't mean we're up to where Denmark or Sweden is, right? So I want to see more streets that are allocated 100% only for bicyclists or foot traffic. I was hit by a car on a bicycle in LA. For 7 years, I only rode bikes in LA, right? And I was hit by this bike, and it was so much of a near-death brush that I didn't ride a bike on a public street for 20 years. And that's ridiculous. Think about how much carbon I could have saved if I had been feeling safe enough to do that, right? Another thing I'd love to see in Chico is installing an anaerobic digester where we could put our collective food waste, manure waste, green waste, and fuel our city. Mm-hmm. I think that the state of California needs to have a commitment to having every roof has solar. I don't think it's appropriate to put solar over desert habitat or agricultural habitat when we need those farmlands or we need those natural ecosystems to thrive. If we already have a footprint of homes, to me, that's the right place to put a solar panel, is where we're already taking up space. And then you have the solar for the person to kind of, you know, thrive, or the business to thrive. So that's my thoughts on that, if that's helpful.
Yes, very helpful. Yeah, I think that Steve and I have been advocates for a long time of closing down roads, and smart growth advocates is just trying to prevent things from going out up into the foothills. And now we're worried about north of Chico, where there is fragile habitat, where there is natural waterway places and extremely complex ecosystems in the foothills. And we're pushing out with, you know, hundreds of houses. Both Stonegate and Valley's Edge are huge developments that will need restoration if they go in.
Because, yeah, it's never as good after as it was before.
Yeah, like, right. Yeah. Right.
I would like to see more vertical, you know, building cities
absolutely
that already exist. Number one. Number two, you know, being unhoused is an awful experience for the individuals affected, but it has a lot of ecosystem impacts as well.
Absolutely.
So I will say that, you know, before sort of gentrification, a lot of urban centers had residence hotels, which is a very small footprint for solving the homeless problem, because somebody gets a room and a shower. And, you know, as a jumping off point, that's a solution. So we have all these people who are committed to houses as a solution. And my suggestion is, let's take existing hotels, turn them into residence hotels, and then work with the people who live in those places and help them reintegrate into society if we can and get a better housing solution in the future. But in the meanwhile, let's at least get them out of tents and out of desperate circumstances. And to be totally honest, when I left UCLA, I spent 8 months living in the Bay Area. And half of those, I did live in a residence hotel because it was inexpensive and I was 22 and what did I care? And it was fine, right? So we need to work on low-cost, quick solutions to our problem. Yes. Instead of dithering over, you know, these giant, overthought, overpriced solutions.
Yes. Yeah, agreed. Yeah, I think both chat has done a fabulous job with that in providing housing.
Yes. And
I think if they had greater community support and greater funding, they could do so much more. And they, you know, a lot of the homeless projects have been shut down. And I totally agree with you in terms of infill and renovations within the city that are as affordable as California can be. Yeah. And
yeah.
We need, But we need immediate solutions. I agree with you about dithering, too.
And as our guests discussed last week on Ecotopia with the new city council, we're in trouble over that. Even this morning's paper talks about the new conservative city council is not going to do anything about the homeless. It's working now on banning needle distribution plans, highly controversial, I realize, but not taking steps to help with the homeless. They haven't discussed the Green New Deal yet, but one cannot be optimistic with the new conservative city council that there's going to be a lot of movement along those lines.
Well, speaking of the Green New Deal, you know, one of the things that interests me is if you look at FDR and when he did the original New Deal, he did lots and lots and lots of individual pieces of legislation. Not all of them passed, but the ones that did became the New Deal. And a lot of the language about Green New Deal describes it as this massive model of the legislation that we're going to put in one place. And, you know, we don't have the votes for that. So what we need to focus on is individual pieces of legislation where we can partner with people all across the political spectrum and get a win. So as an example, NRCS funds conservation plan work on farms to the amount of 5 years worth of 50% pay. So what I'm thinking is, gosh, in a conservative situation, you know, when you need conservative votes, a lot of conservatives are farmers and are familiar and love NRCS. So what if we had those conservation plans be funded 100%? And we said, we're not going to have an application process that takes years. If you apply, we'll get it to you the same year. We could up the amount of carbon drawdown in farms incredibly quickly with an effective piece of legislation. And there's all sorts of opportunities like that, where if we think, if we put ourselves in the shoes of conservative voters, and then we put ourselves in the shoes of, oh my God, we got to solve climate change. There are places nested in the middle of that where we can get to a win. So like an anaerobic digester, like that's a really great project that would bring money and cachet to Chico, solve climate change. It doesn't have to be posited as Green New Deal. It doesn't have to be progressive negative or conservative feisty stuff. It has to be, how can we make stuff better in a way that all of us want? And yeah.
And I'll just put in a quick plug here just to follow up on exactly what you just said, that the Chico Climate Action Commission is doing a lot of really important work moving us toward ways of decreasing our CO2 emissions, and that if you go to Climate Action Commission, the Climate Action has a survey that you can take to support various ideas they have that I think are really great.
So whether it's climate change you want to solve or biodiversity loss that you want to solve, either way, a foundational answer is to put native plants in your own garden, or if you're a farmer, to put them in hedgerows, right? Because you can provide habitat for the species with which we all coexist. You can save pollinators. You're reducing your water consumption and your energy consumption, and you're drawing down carbon. So it's just a win across the board. And what's super interesting to me as I talk to people all around the world is everybody has their own native plants. Everybody has their own ecosystem. So this book is a love letter to the ecosystem I know, right? But you can write your own story and you can plant your own garden and you can have the kind of magic that exists in tree in your front yard or on your balcony even, right? If you put sage or something growing on your balcony, like hummingbird sage, you're going to get beautiful pollinators showing up on your balcony and you're going to have the smell of wildness as a part of your daily life.
Nice.
Melina Watts, we just have a couple minutes left. We want to get back to tree a little bit, talk about where it's traveling next and your plans as a writer and where it's available, both nationally and locally. So tell us a little more about tree and where that project stands.
As to where you can get the book, I know Magna Carta has some signed copies still if you want a signed copy, and they will ship in the United States if you connect to them. They may ship elsewhere, but I will tell you, having done international shipping, it gets really expensive really fast. I sent a copy to a ranger in Kenya that I've become friends with, and that was like, I don't know, it was a $50 ship, you know, but I was like, this is a guy who's out there facing poachers every day, and if he wants to read my book, I'm going to get a copy of the book. Finally, of course, Amazon has it in Kindle form and in paper form.
Thank you so much. This was so interesting. I enjoyed it so much, and we appreciate not only having the book in our world, but having you and Chico to help us see things.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Well, you know what happens with book events is people tell me how they really feel about plants and nature, and I end up feeling every time like I'm making friends with the people in the audience and I want to take them all home. So I'm really glad to get to know you guys, and I so appreciate everything you do.
You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico. Listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And as you know, Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the Corona Conscious Chico Certified Farmers Markets, with year-round markets on Wednesday morning at the North Valley Plaza and on Saturday morning at 3rd and Wall in downtown Chico. The Chico Certified Farmers Markets, connecting farmers and food lovers since 1980. And we'll remind you that we always appreciate responses from listeners about our programs, past, and suggestions for future programs. You can reach us at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com. We're also on the web at ecotopiakzfr.com. You can there listen to recordings of recent shows, see notes about those programs, and in addition, check out our ever-growing list of resources. Thanks very much for listening to Ecotopia. Coming up in just a couple of minutes, it's Bobby Tryon with North State Give and Take. And then at 6:30, it's Radioactive with Ginger Nichols.
Hi, this is Ray Lager, Underwriting Director at KZFR. In these uncertain times, one thing is for certain. You have to reach out to inform the public of any changes in your business or organization. If you'd like to be represented to our thousands of weekly listeners, please contact me at underwrite at kzfr.org. Or call or text me at 520-4742. That's 520-4742. I'd love to share some information about how KZFR can help you in these trying times. Please stay safe, and together we will grow a more compassionate community.
North State Give and Take is made possible by generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the Cotton Party.